You've probably heard the song The Sound of Silence by Simon and Garfunkel. It opens with "Hello Darkness, My Old Friend," which, if we're being honest, is quite dramatic, but also effective. So let's roll with it. The song is usually interpreted as a reflection on isolation or a breakdown in communication. But there are two lines that always stand out to me, especially from an intelligence perspective. People talking without speaking, people hearing without listening. And in today's exceptionally polarized environment, I think those lines point to something important. Because the issue isn't always that communication is failing, it's that interpretation is happening very quickly and often without much discipline. The issue here is that silence doesn't stay empty for very long. We fill it with assumptions, expectations, narratives that feel convincing. And often, the explanation that we settle on isn't just the most plausible. It's often the one that best aligns with how we already feel, which should make all of us, especially those who work in intelligence or decision-making, a little bit uncomfortable. Welcome to the Unknown Knowns, where intuition meets tradecraft. I'm Dr. Angela Lewis, and this is a space for people who think for a living, intelligence professionals, leaders, and decision makers navigating complexity, uncertainty, and imperfect information in a fast-paced world. Each week, we'll explore how intuition, bias, and judgment shape the way that we make sense of complexity and how to get better at it. Today's episode is about silence. Not just what it means, but why it doesn't have one definitive meaning, and how context and uncertainty shape the way that we interpret it. Now, you can see this issue with silence play out pretty clearly with public figures. Take someone like Taylor Swift, hypervisible, globally recognized, and under constant, intense scrutiny. There's an almost reflexive expectation now that figures like her will speak out on major political or social issues. And when they don't, at least not immediately or forcefully, people tend to fill in the blanks. Silence becomes complicity, indifference or acquiescence, strategy or calculated neutrality, avoidance. You pick your narrative. But here's the problem. We don't actually know. Whatever the interpretation may be, it often overlooks a much more complex reality because high-profile public figures aren't operating in a vacuum. They're operating in a psychological, organizational, and security environment that most of us can't fully see. And the truth is, we don't actually know their intentions, which means that we can't reliably assign meaning to their communication choices. In intelligence work, we are trained to be very cautious about this. We're trained not to infer meaning from absence, not to treat missing information as a signal. Because silence doesn't have one single definitive meaning. It only has meaning in context. And sometimes silence is strategy. So instead of asking, what does this mean? We have to ask, what could this mean? Or what are the possible explanations? It's a small shift, but it requires us to consider a broader set of possibilities. And perhaps most importantly, it forces us to think about silence as an ambiguous signal, not a determinative data point. And that shift in thinking creates the space between observation and interpretation, which is where judgment happens. Often, when we see that silence from high-profile figures, we default to a question that says, if you have influence, why would you not use it? But that question rests on a hidden assumption that speaking out is the default. It assumes that speaking is the most responsible or lower-risk choice. And that's not always true. In communication theory, we know that audiences don't just observe public figures. They form relationships with them. Researchers like Donald Horton and Richard Wall first described this as parasocial interaction. It's one-sided relationships that feel personal, even intimate, despite being mediated. More recent work by Rivka Tukhachinsky and others show how those relationships deepen over time into parasocial bonds where identity, values, and expectations become intertwined. So when a public figure takes a position that conflicts with maybe a fan's worldview, it doesn't just register as disagreement, it can feel like betrayal. And when you layer that onto what political scientists like Shanto Iyengar describe as effective polarization, where disagreement is no longer about issues but about identity, you get a much more volatile dynamic. So what does that mean in practice? Well, It means that you're not just dealing with opinions or reactions, but also identity, threat, emotional investment, and even a perceived violation of a relationship, even if it's not one that the public figure has ever actually consented to. And in high-density, emotionally charged environments like concerts, public appearances, or large gatherings, that kind of reaction doesn't stay abstract. It can translate into fixation, escalation, and, in some cases, aggression. Threat assessment research has consistently shown that many actors aren't just expressing beliefs, they're trying to provoke a response, not necessarily because they care about the issue, though they may, but because they want to influence behavior, gain attention, or trigger escalation. In digital environments, this pattern can intensify. And it often follows a predictable cycle: response, escalation, amplification. So from that perspective, silence isn't always absence. Sometimes it's simply a refusal to enter the cycle. And interestingly, this isn't unique to celebrities. We see similar logic in international politics. States will often rely on strategic ambiguity, avoiding clear statements in order to preserve flexibility, avoid escalation, or prevent being locked into a position, because once something is said publicly, it's harder to walk back. So whether you're looking at global politics or high-visibility individuals, there's a similar logic. Not every signal is explicit, not every absence is passive, and not every response reduces risk, which means that what looks like silence may actually be a very deliberate decision about attention, escalation, or risk. So oftentimes, we have a tendency to evaluate silence as a moral choice when, in many cases, it's a risk decision or an intentional context-specific communication strategy. So if silence doesn't have a single definitive meaning, we have to expand the set of possibilities. Because silence is, as I said before, an ambiguous signal. And ambiguous signals require disciplined interpretation. So let's walk through a few common explanations. First, strategic silence. This is intentional non-engagement, a deliberate choice to avoid escalation or deny attention to bad faith actors, or to prevent a situation from getting worse. In many environments, especially highly visible or highly polarized ones, this is not passive, it's calculated. Second, constraint-driven silence. Sometimes people aren't speaking, not because they don't want to, but because they can't. There may be legal constraints, contractual obligations, or significant security considerations. And those security considerations aren't always just about the individual. In high-visibility environments, certain figures can function as what's often referred to as a lightning rod. They attract attention, sometimes disproportionate attention, from a wide range of actors, including those who are looking to provoke, disrupt, or garner visibility for themselves. And when that happens, communication doesn't just carry reputational risk, it can also carry physical and security risk. Not just for the individual, but also for their team, their collaborators, and even their broader fan base. Third, information-limited silence. This is often the simplest explanation. Sometimes people don't speak because they don't yet have enough information to say something responsibly. They're still assessing, gathering context, trying to understand what's actually happening. And to be fair, sometimes by the time they feel that they have developed enough information to form a coherent and thoughtful response, the moment has passed. Fourth, deliberate ambiguity. In some cases, silence is a way of preserving flexibility, of avoiding committing to a position too early and being locked into a narrative that might need to change. This shows up a lot in leadership contexts, where saying the wrong thing too soon can create downstream consequences. And fifth, yes, sometimes it is disengagement. Sometimes silence does reflect avoidance or a decision not to engage at all. It is one possible explanation, but it's generally not the only one. The problem isn't that we interpret silence. We are always going to do that. The problem is that we collapse too quickly into a single explanation, usually the one, like I said before, that feels the most obvious, the one that is maybe emotionally satisfying. So we don't just observe silence, we attempt to complete it. This is the same cognitive impulse we've talked about before, that desire to resolve ambiguity too quickly. Silence just happens to make that impulse a little bit more visible. So the key here is to recognize that in reality, silence alone is rarely determinative. There are multiple plausible explanations, and without context, we don't actually know which one we're looking at. So the goal isn't to stop interpreting, but to interpret silence as a contextualized data point, to recognize that silence and the decision to leverage it strategically exists within a system of incentives and constraints, and systems shape meaning. So when I say context matters, what I really mean is context doesn't just inform meaning, it also constrains it. So let's talk about a few things that shape that context. The threat environment. Visibility can increase reach, but it can also increase risk. Platform dynamics. Engagement amplifies everything. In today's environment, engagement is currency, and conflict, especially emotionally charged conflict, is one of the fastest ways to generate it, which means that any response, even a measured or corrective one, can amplify the very narrative it's trying to address. It increases visibility, expands reach, and often invites further escalation. So in that context, silence can function as a way of denying that amplification. Audience composition. Different groups interpret things differently. Not all audiences are the same. Some are relatively aligned. Others are highly diverse, politically, culturally, and ideologically. And when you're communicating to a large heterogeneous audience, activating one identity can fracture another. So a decision to speak or not speak can have very different effects depending on who is listening. So in some cases, silence is a way of preserving cohesion in a very diverse environment. And finally, constraints and incentives. Every communication decision sits within a broader set of incentives, brand considerations, relationships, contracts, legal constraints, internal dynamics. All of these factors shape what is possible, what is advisable, and what carries risk. So when we look at silence, we're not just looking at a single behavior. We're looking at a decision that is embedded within a broader system of incentives, constraints, audiences, and potential consequences. And if you change any one of those elements, the meaning and implications can shift completely. All communication, including silence, is contextual. In fact, Taylor herself highlighted the importance of context when she said, "You say it in the street, that's a knockout, but you say it in a tweet, that's a cop-out." So let's zoom out for a moment. We tend to think of silence as the absence of action, but often it's not. Silence can be a form of action. It's just operating from a different logic. Because in systems driven by attention, engagement isn't neutral. It has consequences. It can escalate situations, it can amplify narratives, and sometimes it can create risks that weren't there before. Let me unpack that with an example. Imagine a senior executive at a global company publicly takes a strong stance on a contentious social or political issue. For the executive, that decision may be values-driven and feel morally clear. But it doesn't exist in isolation because that executive isn't the only person affected by that visibility. Their organization becomes associated with that position, and by extension, so do their employees. Now, imagine an employee from that company is traveling internationally to a country where those same issues are viewed very differently, legally, culturally, or politically. That employee may or may not share the executive's views, or they may not have engaged on the issue at all. But that distinction may not matter because from the outside, they are still seen as part of that organization. And that can introduce new dynamics, increased scrutiny at the border, greater attention to digital footprint or social media, heightened monitoring of their activities while in country. Not necessarily because of anything they did, but because of the stance their organization is now associated with. So the initial decision to speak publicly wasn't just a communication choice. It was a risk decision with second-order effects. Now, let me be clear. I'm not saying that the executive was wrong to speak. I'm simply saying that the decision to speak on an issue operates across multiple dimensions, including ones that may not be immediately visible. This is why silence can sometimes function as a restraint rather than disengagement. It can and should be a deliberate choice about how much attention to generate and where that attention might go. So this is why interpretation requires contextual discipline. Once we've understood this system of constraints and incentives, we can move from asking, what could this silence mean, to, given this context, what explanations are most plausible? Now, to be clear, silence doesn't always mean strategy, but it's not simple or binary. The key element here, again, is context. I've highlighted examples from executive protection and threat management spaces, but if we're operating in other contexts, like international relations, silence might indicate uncertainty or internal disagreement or deliberate attempts to avoid escalation, or it may mean that communication is happening through back channels. The point isn't what silence means. The point is that silence should always be interpreted through context. If we don't account for that context, we're very likely to get it wrong. So if we go back to where we started, people talking without speaking, people hearing without listening, maybe part of what that captures isn't just a failure of communication, but a failure of interpretation. Because contrary to the idea that silence speaks for itself, in reality, we speak for it. We assign meaning to it. And if we're not careful, we're not just interpreting what we see, but projecting onto it. In our pilot episode, I mentioned the Johari window, named for the psychologist who designed the tool, Joseph Luft and Harrington Ingham. To recap, the Johari window is a 2x2 matrix that helps us to see that there are things that we know about ourselves that others can also see, things that others can see about us that we can't, things that we can see about ourselves that we hide from others, and things influencing us that we haven't yet surfaced, either to ourselves or that are visible to those around us. I mentioned that our biases tend to live in those last quadrants, operating and influencing us before we are even aware of them, sometimes visible to others and sometimes not, but certainly not visible to us until we surface and examine them. The Johari window helps us think about what we know and what we don't. And the idea of unknown knowns sits just adjacent to that. It's not about what's hidden from us entirely, but what's shaping our thinking before we've fully recognized it. And this is where something called epistemic humility becomes really important. At a practical level, epistemic humility is the discipline of recognizing the limits of what you know while staying open to updating your understanding as new information comes in. In short, it's being honest about how certain you really are and leaving space to be wrong. It's knowing the difference between what you know, what you think you know, and what you're inferring, and resisting the urge to conflate them, even when something feels obvious. This isn't just philosophical. Research on judgment and decision-making has shown this pretty clearly. Psychologist Philip Tetlock, who spent decades studying forecasting and expert accuracy, found that the most reliable thinkers aren't always the most confident. They're the most calibrated. They tend to hold multiple plausible explanations in mind a little longer and then use context, new information, and evidence to assess which ones actually hold up. Not all at once, but progressively. Silence is ambiguous, and as we've discussed, ambiguity is not a flaw in the system, it's a feature of complex environments. And how we handle that ambiguity ultimately determines the quality of our judgment. Thanks for listening to The Unknown Knowns. If this episode made you think or rethink, share it with a colleague or friend who's ready to level up their tradecraft. Subscribe for more short, sharp conversations about the art and science of professional judgment. Until next time, stay curious, stay grounded, and keep turning intelligence into impact.